This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'd like to begin, in a sense, at the very beginning. So what we were talking yesterday is to how can we set a context in which the actual concerns of you all, as well as us, can be got to most simply. And what I thought we, or what Ellen suggested, and what I thought was a good idea, would be to begin with a literal sense of writing in the most literal of possible contexts. Now, the supposition, I suppose, on the part of some of you who have come, is that we write poetry. In other words, this is what we do, and we, in effect, have been given a definition publicly as poets. We've published books and all the rest. But that kind of qualification is something I'd not like to take on in this or any other context. So I would like to take up the issue of writing as a physical act. In other words, how I write, and Alan, then what you take it from there. You do the same. In other words, what is involved in writing for me? When I first met William Carlos Williams, I remember, he took me upstairs and to show me where the bathroom was. And he as we went by the bedroom, he showed me this desk that had been in his office when he was in active practice. And he showed me his typewriter, which was a large old office machine, and the way it fitted under the desk. And he showed me the prescription pads that he used to use. And again, Ellen and I were thinking as how the qualification of the size of paper, for example, will often have an effect on what you're writing, whether or not you're using a pencil or a pen. In other words, habits of this kind, which are almost always considered immaterial or secondary. And yet, for my own reality, there's a great connection between what I physically do as a writer, in this sense, and what comes then out of it. Well, so I want briefly to qualify it. I was curious to know how I do it myself, in the sense of what really do I do. Say, first of all, I write always with a typewriter. I get very nervous about using a pen, because pens run out of ink in a way, but ballpoints are what I would use it as and when I do use it that way. Pencils have to be sharpened, and I get involved with the sharpening of the pencil. So also, I think it goes back to a sense I had when younger that typewriting was a professional context. In other words, if you were going to be serious, or going to claim seriousness for yourself, the instrument that you used in writing had to be particular to what the act of writing was. In other words, so that I had, I think, a basically naive sense of this kind, I wanted to be able to do it with a typewriter. Now, equally, I never learned to type. So, I mean, my typing is a habit that's developed with two fingers. I never, took a class in high school or any other place that taught me how to use the full, all your fingers when you're typing. Now, think again. That begins to be a qualification of how fast I can write. In other words, I find that the pace of my writing is concerned with the speed with which I can type. Now, I can type actually about as fast as I can talk with two fingers. I find, for example, if I have to work on somebody else's typewriter, I'm displaced because of there may be a slight variation in the space between keys. In other words, I find that now I can use the typewriter I do use without looking at it, so that I can be thinking of something without consciously wondering where my fingers are. I find, I want to keep on a little bit in the sense of what the physical conditions are. Because again, I started writing in a context where I was embarrassed. I didn't want to bother anybody. I didn't want, don't mind me. We'll just go right ahead with what you're doing. With your serious business, with your serious preoccupation. This was primarily in a former marriage. And I don't want to call attention to myself because they might force me to define what I'm trying to do, which is obviously impossible. So The next thing I would do would be to create a context in which there was a residuum of noise constantly present so that my own noise wouldn't be intrusive. And so I found that you turn on the radio. When I used to be back in New Hampshire, where I think I've really sat down and tried to think of how to write or what to write, I used to play records all the time. We had, at that time, we had one of these big Jensen speakers and all, and an amplifier, and I'd put on the records that I then much valued, as well, Charlie Parker and whatnot, not as a kind of hip, you know, let's be swingers or whatnot, but just because that rhythmic insistence, I think, kept pushing me. I kept hearing it. And lately, for example, in the last year, I finished a long prose work, like a novel, and I found that what I was writing could be actually stimulated by playing particular kinds of music. In other words, I don't know, that I'm not a psychologist or even interested in this aspect.
What
kind
of music?
Well, for example, the whole first part is written primarily to an old Bud Powell a record, where you get these great kind of almost concert style. Again, let's say a poor man's concept of beauty, you know, where you get this these great crescendos of sound, and you get a basically simple melody, as I Got Rhythm or anything playing through this, and then you get this involvement that constantly comes back to the simple statement because it's embarrassed actually with its own hope. So this first part of the novel is written in that sense. Then the whole middle section is written primarily to John Coltrane, where you get deliberate dissonance and you get fragmentation. I wasn't conscious of this, but I mean, then the last part is written to a kind of Nancy Wilson, you know, where you get a where love is gone, dig, and you get this, you get a real slick pretension. In other words, where she's singing, in effect, the memory of some authenticity which she no longer she never met it. Well, I saw her on television, and you get this. She's no slicker than any professional, but I mean, she's singing in a manner which is now a manner. In other words, she's not an innovator, as was Sarah Vaughan, or more particularly Billie Holiday. Again, the middle section involves Billie Holiday. But what I'm trying to say is, so that's a physical requirement for me. I find it very.
Even poems.
Even poems. It's set up. It also gives me something to do when I'm not doing anything. In other words, it gives me something to focus on or to relax back into as a place that I feel safe. So anyhow, the typewriter, the insistence of music, rhythm, something with a strong rhythmic character, not too loud, subtle enough so that you can always go back to it when you're. And paper. Usually, this 8x11 sheet. In other words, I most like the yellow copy paper that has it's not spongy, but it has a softness to it. So that when you type, the letter goes embeds a little. I hate a hard paper. In other words, when you erase this paper, you get take a layer off. Yeah, you get a and. I remember again, now this is why I want to point out, this is not ridiculous, because I remember one time in living in Spain, there was none of this particular size copy paper that I was used to using. So I got this legal sheet, and it was suddenly a terror, because I would finish what was normally my habit of dealing with the paper, and realize that I had about 6 inches left at the bottom that was blank. And this set up a whole different feeling. I remember writing a story actually using this paper, and it seemed to me that things were taking an awful long time. In other words, the whole balance or pattern of the way of working with the thing was being changed. Well, so the paper is significant. Again, Alan and I were talking about, say, Jack Kerouac's. The qualification of his writing that occurs when he's working in his small notebooks. Or I could say the same of Robert Duncan, for example, who uses a uses a notebook and writes in ink. And the composition of his books is obviously done as he's writing. In other words, there is, for example, an actual instance of a book of this kind that he did called Fragments of a Disordered Devotion, in which it's a reproduced from the actual... well, actually, he wrote it as a copy of his own manner. It's an imitation of his manner by himself, so it has that... But you realize that it's all happening visually as well as intellectually or mentally. Olson, in his letters, you begin to realize Olson's spacing, the ordering of where things occur in his thought. He'll begin a letter, you know, like, dear so-and-so, and then start with the information. And before you say halfway through the page, you've got these things jumping all around. The movement is moving, trying to locate, like, let's put that there. Now this goes here. In other words, you can't forget that, but you've got to get this here. You can't put them like that because it's a lie. They don't exist that way. You've got to... He's trying, in effect, to give the orders of his of thought, in no pretentious sense. And a typewriter for him, for example, is something that's much defined his habits of writing, as he said himself in projected verse. But equally, he has a speed in handwriting that's fast. It's a very fast style of writing, but positions and textures of paper, envelopes and whatnot. I find again that in order to be taken seriously by myself, that I again had to create a context in which I could exhibit the instance of professionals. I remember some friend, for example, who said he always washed his hands before he started to write because he wanted to be clean. He didn't want to get anything dirty. I can remember equally when I'd run out of paper in these circumstances, living in some remote place, I would really get, it would be awful. You know, then you'd start to improvise paper from envelopes, but very carefully folding them and all but ironing them out to get the right feeling. What I'm trying to say with all this rambling is that the particular habits of writing that you begin to develop will have, curiously, a great significance for what you write. If you think I'm fooling, you might, for example, try to see what happens if you write with different kinds of medium. In other words, try writing with large crayons. Or, I wish we had access to this. It'd be interesting to see what happens if you try to write on something this size. Where I taught first grade also, and I remember this, where you're writing things like, you have this thing, you've got a pencil like this, and then you go like, I could do this, and keep my hand on it. And then this. And you see, my point is, while I can't write with this, I get so involved with the voluptuous, the sensual. It's distracting to me. Because here's what I'm trying to do. If I'm successful, I am not anticipating what I'm thinking. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to the store in 20 minutes. I'm not anticipating any content before it occurs. At the same time, I'm trying to recognize, or rather, I'm awfully bewildered by the confusions between certain terms for states of consciousness, e.g., the difference between recognition, understanding, realization, knowing. I'm trying to describe a state in which one primarily feels what is happening as a fit balance. If you do things like ski or swim or drive, for example, you know that sense of feeling when the car is operating smoothly, when the balance of the steering and the movement of the car is coinciding with an intention of your own, and it's following with a sense of grace, an appropriateness. Everything is, in effect, falling into place. You're not intentionally putting it there, but you're recognizing the feeling of it's occurring there. So that when I'm writing myself, if something becomes dissonant, or something becomes jarring, arbitrarily, and then I have to stop. One other thing I should note about the sense of the physical act of writing is that the same habit of wanting it wanting it to be, quote, perfect in its appearance means that if I'm writing and I make a mistake, I take the paper out and copy it down to that point, correct the mistake, and then throw the paper away. In other words, I have a great difficulty writing on the paper. For example, I can never write in books. And I get awfully upset if other people write in my books. So I write in my books, big dirty hands all over my books. Because I don't really think that I can own a book. I don't think that I have the right to write.
But if there's director, there's a director. Where's the voice director? I've got to have a voice director.
I get very frustrated.
And in college itself, I think, now let's go back there because that's where we are again. I was in the context of other younger men at that time who wanted to be writers also. Donald Hall, for example. This is in Harvard in 1946. A group that then centered around Wake, Seymour Lawrence, now editor for Atlantic Monthly Press, Kenneth Cope. I remember, say, Kenneth Cope one time invited me up to his room for, I think it was Sherry, and to listen to records like Bach and whatnot, and to read me a few poems. Well, I can remember going up to his room, and it was, you know, it was a very comfortable room. Kenneth comes from a family that has money, and so that was evident in his room. It had the very tasteful reproductions. There was furniture that he'd bought. I couldn't do that. At that time, I wasn't writing anything that I felt that was that significant. I mean, I was desperate to understand what would actually be a poem. And again, as Alan and I were talking yesterday, that you've really come at a good time because I think each of us in our own circumstances has come to that point where the very definition of a poem as a possibility, not as a possibility perhaps, but as an actual construct, is something that we are very unable to state like that. In other words, I cannot define a poem. It's a curious state of mind to arrive at. I cannot tell you what I think a poem is. I think that has to do with the fact that all the terms of consciousness are at the moment undergoing tremendous terms of change. We're thinking of the context now in the States. There's an alteration of very deep order going on in the whole thrust or push of a consciousness, literally the Negro consciousness that has been for years relegated to a kind of underside or underworld. As Duncan says, I see always the underside turning. Well, see, the Negro personality in the States has been forced to live in this underside world, except in context which he could control. Leroy Jones, for example. Personality in the States has been forced to live in this underside world, except in context which he could control. Leroy Jones, for example, grew up in a fairly secure middle class background that had, let's say, the securities of that status. But, you see, there was always a limit to it. You could always take one step beyond the control of the neighborhood and you were suddenly in a world that was utterly unresponsive to your reality. Well, now this reality, you see, is becoming the dominant reality in the States today is the Negro reality. It is not the white reality. It's the Negro reality. And you may want to interpret the activities of the Kennedys as large liberal recognitions that have been long overdue. But I think you'd be utterly naive to do so. I think that the Kennedys are being washed along in a shift that is not only located in the States, but now Alan can tell you much more accurately these terms, but is coming from a whole shift of control communication terms that's actually centered in Africa and in Asia. I don't want to take that too far afield, but my point is that the very premise on which consciousness operates is undergoing modifications that none of us, I think, are at the moment capable of defining. We can only recognize them. Let's say that if Pound says artists, what are the antennae of the race? Mm-hmm. I think that any of us here, let's say, is in a position to be responsive to this feeling that's so immense there now, and so definite and so insistent. Not because we can do anything with it, but because it simply is. It's a deep change. It's a deep change in consciousness. And I'm curious to see what's going to happen, which is a mild way of putting it. Indeed. But you have a poem, Alan, which you say, "Where all Manhattan that I've known must disappear." You know. And this, to me, is what is happening in the space in a different relationship or in a different context, where all the terms of consciousness that I grew up with must disappear, are disappearing momently, daily. The terms of reality are changing. Even the term of this course is changing, by which I mean that this course would have been impossible 10 years ago by definition. Senses of writing would have been impossible to present in this fashion 10 years ago. We were happily involved with a reorganization of premise that gave us our particular occasion. Yours is going to be perhaps even more immense. I mean, I think that the change that's occurring now is more significant than the Second World War by far, because it's the residue of that war in reference to the atom bomb, and equally the shift in all terms of human relationship that have been habitualized since, let's say, oh God, thousands of years. This goes back to to reorganize premises that have existed for thousands of years, concepts of person. Look, I'd like you to talk for a while. or let's not to interrupt. It's not only pleasant but equally useful to sit down in someone else's chair, by which I mean to enjoy the all the familiarity. Like I'm wearing another man's coat. It's not only pleasant, but equally useful to sit down in this chair, by which I mean to enjoy the all the familiarity. Like I'm wearing another man's coat this morning. And I'm sitting here feeling the pleasure of wearing another human being's clothing. It's a lovely feeling. But in writing, if you happen to be a very good friend and to wear his coat is a pleasure, because it's a way of feeling that's a very natural and relaxed way of speaking. It pertains to the sense of innocence or to the sense of commonness that I like to feel also.
So, to begin with, as she was saying, how when I write, I keep a notebook of this or any other series and fill them out. Using a notebook on a kind of otherwise, all the papers will get lost. It'll be too much to carry around because I'm traveling, so this keeps it all. So this keeps it all in one spot. And also, because I want to see what happens one after another, like it's a journal or a continuity. Now, I always used to do that, but even when I was younger, use a notebook form, which mainly I got from Kerouac. Before that, I wrote poems on typewriter paper. But I sat down and said, I'll write a poem and then type out a poem. Or wrote it in one hand and typed it out. But then I don't know where to begin, actually. But right now, what is happening is I just write anything I can get written at home. And this is what I'm moving around. The size of the page then determines what the line is going to be like generally, unless I have some real specific idea that I want a great big long line. Unless I have like a big inspiration exactly at that moment, what it is. But generally, if I start writing in a little notebook like this, then whatever modifications of my thought come after that. So that I'll be sitting, say, in a bus, I get a phrase coming in, write that down, and underneath that, list all the other ideas that come that make some kind of sense. One after another, the way they would fall, whether simply the way, any way I can get them down. So any way I can get them down in a short, in a little notebook like this is real short little lines. In a big notebook, then you can get anything you want. I should be long for this thing. In India, I found a notebook that was no lines in it. Most of all the notebooks I ever had before had ruled paper. This had no ruled paper, which means that there's even more freedom on the page to drop down droppings from the morning. So you can do, so it comes out anyway, finally. We're messy, in a sense. And the reason for messy is what I'm interested in is what kind of the accident that will take place while I'm writing that will embarrass me or reveal what it is that I'm preoccupied with that I could not formulate if I was sitting down to write a poem. Because if I was sitting down to write a poem, first then I'd have to worry about like what kind of form am I using here? And then originally, when I was 17, it would be a rhymed iambic quatrain, or iambic pentameter, or a hexameter line. But that would determine then what I was going to say, and that would make me keep following like on a track. So then it wouldn't even be a poem. It can't even be a poem now, because if I start writing a poem, that'll mean it has to be determined in advance that it's a poem later. Jumping around, and it's one thought after another that don't necessarily have a relationship, but are just the thoughts that I'm thinking, in other words, stream of consciousness in a way. Notations of things going through the mind. Then, for that, a big notebook with a big page. Blank, completely blank, that leaves me open completely to write anything anywhere I want. But the point of all this is that maybe it's something that's obvious to you from the very beginning. I'm not sure that, you know, what are we teaching? We're supposed to be teaching here, of course, is it poetry or writing?
It says poetry and criticism.
Okay, we're teaching poetry and criticism. So in a way, it's not a con really for us to be teaching poetry, but apparently poetry is shifting, and we are shifting. Apparently, you are interested in that shift. So what the shift specifically is? No, that's not the final battle. That's not really con.
With
psychiatrists now, apparently, what they're doing is they just talk back and forth.
Yeah.
And
tell that experience with the old Freudians and the new people. Apropos. In other words, in Dodds has a book called Greeks and the Irrational, and there's just a footnote that says it's been observed that almost all instances of so-called irrational or non-conscious speech take on, you know, a definite rhythmic quality. This apparently has been the occasion or the qualification ever since recorded instances of this kind were made. So that what we're trying to do, partly, I'm not going to anticipate I anticipate what you feel, but trying to gain a sense of form that is not always organized or predisposed or habituated or premised by some mental act that is anterior, not only anterior to the actual composition, but precedes and defines it before it can even occur. Literally, I had a friend who never really got married because he had such a distinct idea of whom he wanted to marry, so that no one could possibly satisfy the possibility that must equally be present. Where I'm trying, for example, personally, to to destroy all the habits of organization that I learned. In other words, I started going back to that scene as my intensely, increasing insistence on state formality was an attempt to defend myself against qualifications which I couldn't even understand. I remember sitting in college, I took Latin too, and I never understood what they were talking about in terms of the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
I was too inept with Latin to hear it. I had no habit of understanding a language that could qualify metrics for me in this fashion. And to this day, let's say in the most simple context, someone says, what kind of rhythm does that have?
Mm-hmm.
Iambic pentameter, I can't hear it. I mean, I'm embarrassed by not being able to hear that kind of generalized mm-hmm. organization. I can only hear it very specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the sense is now that once the form precedes the occasion, I despair, because mm-hmm. we live in a world in which that's happened desperately. William says, hitherto men have been unable to realize their wishes. It's actually a quote.
Mm-hmm.
Now that they can, they must either change them or perish. And
mm-hmm.
I personally believe with great intensity that in poetry, as in any instance of human activity presently, the concept must be attacked where it exists, namely in the habit that gives it its reality.
Mm-hmm.
It must be. In other words, if one says, I love you, I don't mean suddenly to scream back, I hate you, but
mm-hmm.
something, all these attitudes must be, in effect, be allowed to redistribute themselves as the content which is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a very obvious parallel between that and the act of composition. I think that, I was thinking as you were talking, if you turn the page of paper this way, you find that there's a shift. All of you, for example, have written a poem that's gone more than one page. Realize what's happened when you take out the one page and put a new page in.
Mm-hmm.
A whole sense of a whole new organization occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyhow, that's what we're trying mm-hmm. to deal with.
So,
yeah.
So we began talking then now about the most primary business of like what kind of paper you use, what kind of notebook, almost in a sense as a beginning on which perhaps we can erect a great structure of composition. But the whole point, finally, is that what we're going to wind up with, or what I am faced with when I sit down to write, is that beginning every time. It's like not knowing anymore each time I sit down to write. Not consciously knowing anymore what I should do, what I'm supposed to do, is this what I'm supposed to do next? What am I supposed to do next? I'm supposed to write a big poem now. But, okay, so then I can't, obviously. So then the next thing I have to turn in, I don't even know why I want to write, except it's an old habitual relationship. And finally, it really actually it even comes back, maybe it's not necessary, maybe that's a waste of time too. But meanwhile, I don't want to take that step. Get out of language entirely, get out of speech entirely. I still like that. Or it appeals to my
Do you know, you ought to read it if you haven't. Alan had a letter in response to Mark Schleifer, the Schleifer, asked him, in effect, what he thought about the Cuban Revolution. And he wrote an answer, a discussion, really, in Sacred Time, of all this premise of the dilemma. It's in an issue of Palante, the first issue of a magazine called Palante, Palante. I think it was available in Duffy's for a while. I remember they had some copies of it. You can get it through them. If you want to see it, we'll contrive to get you a copy. It's a very useful.
So then, in a way, the horror then, well, it's not here, whatever, of this situation is like, what right have we got to drag you down to our level? But it's to put you in a position which I find in some respects very tormenting and uncomfortable, that of totally not knowing what I'm doing and of having to like face life every day or face the universe every day, completely disoriented, except oriented to the fact that there is no ready answer and there's no ready formulation, and that I have to live in whatever I'm doing, but on the page, if I'm writing, if that's the area that I'm dealing with, then I have to invent a whole existence out of nothing then and there. So that's what gives whatever I write is sort of actually a really shrewd way of approaching it. You don't have anything on anybody. You don't have anything up your sleeve, except that you can hide on a bare page like that in that kind of a situation, or you can give yourself away But anyway, it makes a kind of democracy between you and your reader, where you're not threatening your reader, and your reader can, you can make love to your reader, or your reader can, you can make it like Whitman says, who touches this, touches a man. So, in other words, finally, there is no theory to teach, except that it should fall, or that we have to teach. I mean, there may be somebody else got some other kind of problem. Love Henry, so he wants to put down. But apparently, we seem to be in a, yeah, both in a state of total bankruptcy now, as artists, and so naked now. You know.
That's your most valuable time, is when you feel
it, when you
feel as though,
wow,
it's all gone out.
It's an awfully difficult time, personally.
It's very unpleasant.
How would you like to be a doctor? And someone says, come and perform an operation, save this man's life, and you suddenly, you've never seen these instruments before.
Yeah.
You haven't the least sense of what to do.
As a doctor, if you are the doctor, then I'm the doctor, he's the doctor.
Well, let's think of Duncan's sense. But is he a doctor when he's not being a doctor? And how does he know when he's going to be a doctor?
Well, I mean, the point is, how open are you?
Yeah,
but how open?
I don't want to be the habit of myself,
you see.
Yeah, but I want to get off the street if I can't, so to speak. If I can't, I don't want to find myself suddenly around the hospital like Dr. Benway, you know. At least have the integrity of his own purposes. But, yeah. Pardon? Not at the moment. Not now. Not right now. I have a hard time, too. Yeah. Yeah. Pardon? I find myself extremely dissatisfied with the habits of my own terms of consciousness. I mean, I found it in my own life, for example. Let me give an instance. I'd frankly been married before once. The habits of that relationship became intolerable. The marriage disintegrated. I met and married my second wife, and I found immediately, as a great revelation to me, that whatever identity I had could be real in multiple senses. I mean, I found that I was, I mean, the eye I'd see in the mirror was the same old smiling Bob, you know, but the way I felt about the world was very distinct. And I find, I know friends, close friends, say, feel me at times, not a son of a bitch, but at least an awfully arbitrary man, because I am so much where I am that I tend to pick up the loyalties that are present in that place. So that I'll sit down with one friend and talk about A, then go talk with A about B, whom I've just come from. And I can't personally feel any inconsistency in this, because I don't understand how otherwise one is to feel. I'm not interested in being right or wrong or in committing myself to attitudes finally, except to a very few indeed, e.g. to my wife and to the premise of the reality that involves. Even that is dangerous.
Is there anybody here that doesn't understand what we're saying or why we're saying? Is there anybody here that has any...
No, I witnessed this. This is a great vindication of our
reception wasn't an excuse for making a radio, you know?
No, I, no, this is, yeah, look, no.
Well, the complaint is, it's not a question of right or wrong.
No.
It's not a question of right or wrong. It's a question now. No, you shut up a minute. We're talking to you. Wait a minute. You understand up to a certain point. Up to a certain point. But it's too hard, I think. You know, now the vibration I'm getting from moving. Okay, I can't insist on my own vibration being accepted, you know. But nonetheless, the vibration is that if you write, what do you write then? Are you really naked when you're writing, or are you giving ideas about freedom?
Not necessarily naked when you write, but what difference does it make when I'm naked?
Oh boy.
See, but here we're dealing with the problem of writing.
That's a big turn.
Yeah, that's a big turn. That's a big turn. I want to be more tenderly naked than that. no, I don't. I mean, sometimes I don't, sometimes I do. But you're making it too hard, and you'll make me put my clothes on again. So I don't, so that's what I feel, this whole problem is like, that everybody completely, in rapport, see, whether or not it's right or whether or not it's wrong doesn't make any difference. That's beside the point. Whether or not the idea is clear, but, for instance, she feels, you feel, that we are being too apologetic about writing poetry. I sure do. Yes, I do. So we want to deal with that. Ill at ease-ness.
Yeah, and see what that premise is.
We want to deal with that ill at ease-ness rather than putting it off in us. See, it would be possible for me to say I am Allen Ginsberg of a specific identity, reinforced by a tremendous amount of fame. I know exactly what I'm doing. I can make it like that. I can write it all the poems I want. I can sell them anywhere I want, so I can call myself a poet, and maybe even make it on another level, on a pretty interesting level, and maybe make it all the way that way. However, I am more interested in the areas of my own being, which are not just only Allen Ginsberg, which is a poet. See, I'm interested in, or I'm, which more than the one identity which is going to produce a poem recognizable like any other poem I, like other poems I wrote. So that other people will say, well, I got it, so doing it real good then. We'll make it. I'd rather not make it in the sense of, I'd rather keep living or rather go on to something that keeps changing my identity or seeking an identity which is central and almost identifiable with God or with something which is universal enough to satisfy me and not make me afraid of dying completely or even, or something which, you know, makes me willing to die. So I can't make it if I'm writing poetry. It isn't enough. Poetry just doesn't make it. It doesn't get there. Poetry is not enough. Quote poetry, unquote.
Yeah.
So when we say we're not writing poetry, we're not writing poetry as we have known it before, as it is known by other people, as it is taken for granted. Invention is a question of inventing anew, something that will satisfy all the new conditions of feeling that we've got. Or if not satisfying, that's his name, satisfy all these terms. Something that will, for me, express, or maybe even resolve on paper, if that's possible, all the new elements that have come into my life, like going to Asia, so that's a whole big different awareness of what life is like than anything I had here. Or now, recently, with New Year, I seem to be having a slight heterosexual period. So, like, that's a whole new reality that I've got to deal with that breaks up formulations that I've had before and makes my relations with people a little bit different. So, like, now if I were stuck as a poet having to satisfy that identity and that one that's already built up, or if you, as students, quote unquote, are stuck being students and we're stuck studying quote poetry, which is his point, you know, why be stuck in this class hung on poetry, which is well taken, but we've got to get around back to it.
For
your writing? But we're all going to have to invent it, I guess.
Yeah.
We are all going to have to invent that form.
Yeah, well,
how are we going to run it?
You're right.
Well, how can we change it? Well, how can we change it?
That's the hang. We had this, no, really.
What shall we do?
You know, last year, where we sat in a room that we tried to destroy every time we get into it. And, I know.
Well, I don't want to necessarily see outside in the room. Maybe you, okay. You want trees. Oh, you want trees? Oh, you want space.
But again, you know, we have to talk where we can. The point is, we have to talk where we can. We're given this this is not an excuse, but this is a fact. I mean, we have to talk where we are. We can't. I mean, I very much agree with you.
There'll be this afternoon, for one thing, this afternoon. You'll all come over to Warren's house. We'll all be there. That'll change it. We'll have a garden. We'll have trees. And also more intimacy. No, more intimacy, possibly. So that, you know, we can figure
it out. I want, just because we're getting so close to it, and it sounds absurd as an underline, but I hope that no one will be disappointed that we're not going to think of the whole business of the whole situation of poetry as an instance of formal exercises to be learned. I mean, you must realize you wouldn't be here if you weren't utterly clear that this is a sense of poetry that neither one of us can admit or endure. It's intolerable to us.
I don't mind it for somebody else.
No, well, I mean, it's intolerable to me. That's what I'm saying. I remember Duncan, for example, to Paul's anthology, which Robert at the time felt was a pleasure to be accepted. He said, it's a pleasure. It's nice that they care. You know, they're going to put us in it. But when the actual book came out and we looked through it, so this is a tremendous disappointment that I felt, and I then asked him how he felt about it, and it was the same. In other words, we found that the particular people that had been allowed in this door, namely myself, Gary Snyder, Duncan, and Denise Levitoff, as Robert said, the distinction is they don't believe in inspiration. They don't believe they think that you write poetry by describing a physical form. They think that a poem is primarily the same issue as this cup, that you can make a poem as distinctly as you can make a cup.
The well-wrought urn.
Yeah, the well-wrought urn. And we've come through a period, again, Alan and I grew up in it, so to speak, where this sense of forming a poem and this sense of writing poetry was dominant. I don't mean to attack people who don't exist, but this, we cannot deal with that. We're trying to think
exactly. The problem is that we are one
junk.
Yeah.
Well, I think
it
does sound like something about those things which endure, those things which only do not only endure, but
this is only emotion in the earth.
I think you're thinking of making the poem, you know,
it's obscene. I mean, it's obscene if I think of it as making it.
If you think it's obscene, then I ask you, what are you going to do?
I don't know what I'm going to do. I never have. Honestly, never have.
So our problem is like this.
I don't think the poem is like waking up in the morning. I just don't think that. I mean, I love
them to be the sweetest. Oh, I think that would be a swear. No, I'm sorry. I'm being stupid right now.
Jack Gilbert.
I'm being stupid right now.
Jack Gilbert.
It's more like making a pot of coffee. A bad pot, if you wish. Or any kind of one. With salt or with a little almond.
It's more like
that than it is like waking
up in the morning.
To me,
I'd rather wake up in the morning.
I think it's
the accident
of
anything. Well,
let me just give a brief
answer.
Jack Gilbert, if you know his work, lives in San Francisco and all. I saw him last October. We were walking up the street together, and he pays me the dubious compliment of respecting me as a writer. By which I mean, I don't think it is a compliment, but he was saying, now, when you write these poems of yours, you know what you're going to do. Don't you plan them? And I was, come on now, Bob, give me the truth. You know, like, don't you really figure these out? You know, how can you do that without figuring that out? In other words, sitting down and deciding to write a poem that's going to do this or that little trick. And I honestly could not convince him that I don't. He thought that to say that I didn't was an even grosser pretension than to, you know, than to do it. He said, this is the way I do it. I actually also met a man who had poems in the style of every poet that he felt to be making it presently writing, and he thought that this was an utterly legitimate instance of poetry. And I see that can make very close distinctions. The sense, like I'm wearing another man's coat, which I find, as I was saying, a pleasure. At times I'm very conscious of writing another man's way of feeling or saying things because I find that also a pleasure. In other words, it would be absurd to say that, quote, imitating or using the forms of another man's way of gaining or getting to terms of feeling was wrong, because this is frankly is the process of learning how to get the articulation into a state of possibility. But it is very distinct, I feel personally, from the actual writing of what we call loosely a poem. Mm-hmm. As Robert, again, Duncan says, it's like you feel a kind of readiness for it. You feel like I feel I want to take a walk. Or I feel a kind of occasion or something is going to happen. But I couldn't possibly define when, where, how. And when I find that an habituation, in other words, when I get a letter, so to speak, it's now it more frequently happens from some friend or other person saying, do you have anything to send? I suddenly find myself confronted with that need, and I want to satisfy it. I mean, I want to satisfy it in a multiplicity of senses. I enjoy the vanity of being asked. I mean, I enjoy the vanity I feel when I am asked. I want to satisfy that friend's sense of what I can do, and yet it's not possible. I remember once hearing Graves come down, we were talking about this last night, Graves coming down the stairs into the apartment in Palma saying he was halfway through a poem for the New Yorker. And this frightened me and offended me as a younger man, because I'd been reading his very books where he says that everything occurs as a blow. It's just suddenly you're struck. I don't know. Again, I'm reduced to I only know what's there. If there's nothing there, I don't know it. You see, how can I anticipate what I don't see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I start writing them, and the things seem to tie together, and they seem to happen. I don't know, or they're trying to say something.
Yeah.
And maybe, subconscious or
yeah.
Something from underneath, but when I start off, I don't have any clear idea of what I'm saying.
Well, I would share that feeling with you very exactly. I don't know what I'm saying until I've said it. Then I think would be, in other words, I don't, then I am conscious. And then, in effect, I make that perhaps utterly specious judgment as to what has happened and as to what I feel it to be. And whether
well, what happens whether finally during composition?
Yeah.
You say a pattern emerges for you. Well, it does for me too, but that doesn't find a satisfaction.
No.
Just, you know, like something that on a rational or a surreal level is interesting. Because that also is a little flat. So what I've been finding is that sometimes, at best, what seems to happen out of that openness or out of that freedom, out of that not knowing where you're going, the stealing in on the body and on the mind of an old familiar feeling of self or of identity or non-identity, lately would be located somewhere in my belly, which sometimes makes me cry, or sometimes makes me feel like a heroic seraphim, or like me. but it makes me feel very sensitive, like a lost kid suddenly found. So that's what that's the goodies, the icing, that with consciously now, I look for during this process. So in other words, it isn't a question of just floating around centerless, looking for whatever crazy scattering you can do with the mind. But that's also interesting. It's better than a rigid, old-fashioned hang-up beginning. But actually, in a sense, there is a something to hang it all on, in a way.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was being cheap at your expense for it. I didn't mean it.
Let me just say, some of you probably know Lionel Kern's work, sitting in the front row. And Lionel, for example, was working for about a year or more with a very conscious apprehension of a rhythmic balance of words and complex. He was very interested to see what the formal, where the pivot point of the rhythmic term occurred in the sense of line. And you, for example, worked at that until you knew that not so much you were right or wrong, but you had the experience of what that thing was. Didn't you then find yourself very bored? Yeah. Now that's what I'm feeling. Yeah. In other words, not so much you not only knew what it was, but the habit of seeing it that way became intrusive too. It began to. You found yourself writing. I found myself, for example, in poems that had perhaps a similar preoccupation. I found myself writing poems to satisfy this knowledge. And God, that is boring. I mean, that is horrible. That's terrifying. When you find yourself doing things to satisfy something that you know, it's all over, you know. Yeah.
As you're writing, to what extent does a consciousness of acquired talent or talent ability enter into your
being? Well, you're shrewd, you know. You're shrewd, you don't know all that. And that's all there.
But it's the point. You get a hold of an idea, and suddenly you have a person that becomes as blatantly avaricious, you know, not with a poetic, beautiful character feeling that you get in your stomach. You know, if you can get as avaricious, then everything is in a balance. You see, for every bit of wonderful and hanging on to the small idea thing that you have, you also have a thing underneath the thing.
Because now, up to a certain point. Yes.
But if you're a Puritan,
so now he's a Puritan, he rejects that.
Oh, well, okay.
I care.
No, I'm not a Puritan. I'm not a Puritan, so I see that as another seraphic role, yeah. Sort of. However, sometimes it gets to be too much.
I mean, by that, I reject it in the sense that it delights me. And I'm afraid of getting being too pleased.
Mm-hmm.
So that I'm afraid that my wife is content to tell you this, when things are happy for me, and when I'm completely content and happy in my world, I become utterly depressed. Because I'm worried that something's going to happen to disturb it, you know?
Are we making sense to everybody?
What?
No, because there are fallibilities. No.
Of course. The assumption that...
Which?
Well,
no, because, it's good to check back to make sure... Here is the point, I'm sure, except I don't want to embarrass the one that 2, 3, 4, 5. There are some people who are not familiar with the experiences, nor the terms, the language we are using. Fuck you. Let you rush it for a while. You'll make it. But other, you know, so everybody will make it, but nobody in hell is the point. Nobody should be in hell. Otherwise, I'm going to be in hell. Well, I am here.
Nothing like sitting in the midst of something for a while and just to see if you can do it yourself rather than being questioned
as to whether or not. Well, all I remember is when I had to rough it and make it, I couldn't, so I want to help.
Let me just interrupt just in this thing. When I was younger, I believed, this earlier business I was talking about, I believed that there was something as distinct as a poem could be as distinct as a cup or anything else. I thought that this was true, that I could learn how to write poems. I thought that, say, at that time, Wallace Stevens much impressed me. I thought that you could learn to write in this distinctive fashion. In other words, I had the sense perhaps parallel to a carpenter talking about tools. I thought, and it was true, that you learned how to use tools of language or whatever, however to characterize them, that you could learn these and that then you could write. And for a time it satisfied me. By which I mean, I think, I'm thinking of Duncan's sense of, there's that time when we're younger, when we want to be poets. In other words, we want distinctly to have that experience and to be able to write that thing which is characterized as a poem. And then we perhaps luckily or otherwise satisfy that, again this word is persistent, we satisfy that feeling, we have that. But at some point, this not so much is no longer, it is utterly not the point anymore. Now that I've satisfied my ambitions, I'm stuck with what I feel is continuing possibility, and I'm much more interested in that than in that earlier sense, or argument or ambition that wanted to make me a poet, when I thought that poems were extricable objects, or substantial things that could be attached to my person as pleasant acquirements. I no longer feel that possible. So what I'm trying is, I would like us to be understood simply in this way, that each one of you will have to suffer that experience, because I don't personally know any other way to arrive at it. As Warren was saying, either one of us, conscious of the abilities we may have acquired? For my own answer to that question, I am not conscious of the abilities I've acquired, let's say, from habits of writing, except as I feel them intrusive. In other words, when I see my own tricks, I'm terrified, because I'm not allowing things to happen. I'm saying, we'll do it this way, we'll do it that way. I'm making choices that are immaterial, because they are apart from the actual feeling or experience or content that's declaring itself. I do believe form is never more than the extension of content, in the sense that if you anticipate the occasion, you may find yourself as ridiculously situated as, let's say, arriving at a formal dinner dressed in a bikini. I mean, you've chosen the wrong dress. In other words, now, at the same time, there is always a choice in writing. In other words, you as you recognize what is happening, you choose. But I hope I would rather choose intuitively. I would rather, in effect, destroy that ego center that wants so continually to arbitrate the reality of which I am the existence, so as to preclude or define or make possible to be comfortable. You see, again, the Puritan habit of comfort.
Well, so finally, the tools that you were asking about, or the acquired talents, in a moment of crisis, or when you're writing utterly, they tend to disappear, to be forced out by the pressure of a new sensation, a new experience, and the confusion of realizing you're stuck in the universe, experiencing a situation you haven't experienced before, having to register that. So, like, a few things remain, like the fact that you're writing. It's an acquired. I mean, the fact that you acquired a notebook before. I acquired a notebook and a pen. But ultimately, the tools, which is to say the smartnesses, that were the tricks that he was talking about, they disappear too, finally. Okay. No.
Well, that's actually one.
That was way later. I never knew I've written a poem until long after that. That was all right. That to write that down and that it really is a poem.
I don't mean poem to write. I mean previous poem. Like the confidence you're a writer, and this helps you
explain
whatever.
David Tudor.
I was more confident than anybody else is.
David Tudor, one time, he plays without score. You know, in fact, the music is so familiar with it that he uses no score. He describes an experience where he was actually giving a concert performance, like they say, and he, you know, he went like this, and he couldn't remember anything. Now my sense is that I feel a literal burden, and that I have to get over this, in the sense of each poem that I've written adds to the term of a habit, and in terms of a public reference, which plays back on me as a human being, a responsibility of all things that makes me wonder, am I going to make it? You know, when I start to get involved with that sense, you say, does the poem give me confidence? The poems I've written almost destroyed my confidence and my ability to write, because they're saying, well, you did it that time, but now can you do it again? Can you do it again?
Maybe. Well, can you stay in the same universe and do it again in the same universe as the other one, just when you want to go to another universe?
And you say, well, I'm not even the same man.
Yeah.
All the aspects of one's own use of language, as distinct from general structure and whatnot. All the
ideas about
one of us, for example, has a habit to speak. Words that are repetitive or habitual in the way we speak, characteristic gestures. All of these can be awfully intrusive in writing, to the extent that they will often get us started. I was noticing in Alan's conversation the weight you put upon sometimes. This relates to a sense of reality to you very obviously. Well, I was thinking of a poem of yours that begins sometimes when my eyes are red. I've had that poem in my mind for a long time, and I realized that sometimes there states a whole context that's very intimate to your way of feeling. And I have other ways. I have, for example, a habit of beginning with a statement which I immediately contradict, so as to satisfy just to satisfy the qualification before it can occur. Uh-huh. You know, I know I'm no good, but on the one hand and on the other, you know, something you say with these tremendous weights on both your hands, and you have your feet left.
But the yogis in India say that, I'm saying, maybe I should study yoga, not write poetry. So, one tantric yogi said, well, poetry is a sadhana, like yoga sadhana, the disciplined path, the mode. So I said, but yeah, but when you get to a state which is beyond language, then what are you doing with poetry? And he said, well, yoga is the same way. You've got to drop that too, finally.
Yeah.
You know, like very formal studies of all the techniques of breathing and all that has to be finally dropped because that's irrelevant to the object of the seeking.
We were talking again last night apropos Gary Snyder, who's version of calling the living in Japan, and Alan was telling me this sequence of questions and the attempt and effect of this discipline is an attempt to relocate the area of perception of consciousness so that it is not always an activity or a thing or a reality dominated by some insistent ego, so that you get the questions, for example, the sound of two. What is the sound of one hand clapping, which forced the mind to realize its own inability and to draw from other senses of being. You see, in other words, embarrassment,
literally other parts of the
tricking it into acknowledgement of its own limits. I mean, after all, the most monstrous thing in the world is a man who thinks and lets his thinking be the limit of his reality. In other words, if we were all stuck with our thought as the limit of what we feel, it would be a very poor world indeed.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
so actually, it's a battle of the politics of the nervous system that's involved.
Yeah.
About what center of the nervous system dominates the poetry.